Chapter 45, Krishna rescues his teacher's sons. Text 9, hopefully.
Well, it's not working at this moment.
Okay, just read the verses then. Text 9. Tachantum arhatastata matur now paratantrayo akruvatorvam shushrusham klishtayord duhrida prisham. Tut that, shantum, forgive, arhata, you may please, tata, O father, mata, O mother, now on the part of us, paratantrayo, who are under the control of others, akurvato, not executing, vam, your, shushrusam, service, klishtayo, caused pain, duhrida, by the hard-hearted kamsa, vrisham, greatly. Translation and purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Dear father and mother, Krishna speaking, please forgive us for not serving you. We are not independent and have been greatly frustrated by cruel kamsa. Purport. According to the Sanskrit grammar, the words paratantrayo and klishtayo may also refer to Vasudev and Devaki. Actually, Vasudev and Devaki were under the control of providence and were disturbed by the activities of kamsa, whereas Sri Krishna is always the absolute personality of Godhead. So we'll read through to text 14, text 10. Shukadeva Goswami said, thus beguiled by the words of Lord Hari, the supreme soul of the universe, who was by his internal illusory potency appeared to be a human. His parents joyfully raised him on their laps and embraced him. Pouring out a shower of tears upon the Lord, his parents, who were bound up by the rope of affection, could not speak. They were overwhelmed, O King, and their throats choked up with tears. Thus having comforted his father, his mother, and father, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, appearing as the son of Devaki, installed his maternal grandfather, Ugrasena, as the king of the Yadus. And, I'll go through 14, I think. The Lord told him, O mighty king, we are your subjects, so please command us. Indeed, because of the curse of Yayati, no Yadu may sit on the royal throne. Purport. Ugrasena might have told the Lord, my dear Lord, it is actually you who should sit on the throne. Anticipating this statement, Lord Krishna told Ugrasena that because of Yayati's ancient curse, princes in the Yadu dynasty could technically not sit on the royal throne, and therefore Krishna and Balaram were disqualified. Of course, Ugrasena also could be considered part of the Yadu dynasty, but by the order of the Lord, he could sit on the royal throne. In conclusion, these were all pastimes the Supreme Lord enjoyed as he played the part of a human being. And the last verse today. Since I am present in your entourage as your personal attendant, all the demigods and other exalted personalities will come with heads bowed to offer your tribute. What then to speak of the rulers of men? Purport, Lord Krishna then assures Ugrasena that he should confidently take the throne. Om Agyanatim Randasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshu Nivitamina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpatruvishcha Kripasindhuvyevicha Patitano Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. So in these verses in the Bhagavatam, we're hearing about Krishna's relationship with his father and mother, Devaki and Vasudev. And then towards the end here, we're also hearing about how he installs Ugrasena on the throne. I'm mostly going to talk about Krishna's relationship with his parents and about spiritual relationships. But also, just to cover this part that was at the end of these verses, they mentioned the installation of Ugrasena on the throne. Of course, Ugrasena was Kamsa's father. Although Devaki and Kamsa were called brother and sister, Ugrasena was not the father of Devaki. Devaka was her father, so I guess they're half-brothers and sisters or something. But because of, it might seem natural at this point, Krishna and Balaram had come, this triumphant entry into Mathura. They had destroyed Kamsa's wrestlers, his guards, his whole army, and then Krishna very, almost nonchalantly, kills Kamsa, who was the most powerful personality in on the whole planet at that time. So obviously Krishna could be seen as the rightful ruler of the kingdom. He was obviously the most powerful, and many people were beginning to see that perhaps this was the personality of Godhead. But he, because of this this curse of Yayati, said they should not be qualified to sit on the throne. What happened with that was that many generations before, Yayati was a great king, and it's a long story, which I will simplify, but basically he had a number of very colorful adventures, some of them a little bit on the lusty side. He managed to get himself cursed by Sukracharya in relationship with Sukracharya's daughter, and Sukracharya cursed him that he would immediately become an old man and simultaneously lose his sexual potency. This was, of course, something very much not to Yayati's liking. He took this very hard, and there was some talk back and forth, and then Sukracharya said, well, if you can get one of your sons to take the curse, then you'll be relieved of it. So Yadu was the oldest son of Yayati, and so he goes to Yadu, and Yadu says, no way. I'm not going to take this on and become old and give up my youth. Now, at one point, somewhere Srila Prabhupada explains that Yadu was, of course, a great devotee, and he knew his future role as a progenitor that would eventually lead to the birth of Lord Krishna. So knowing that, in other words, he shouldn't accept this on behalf of his father because he had a vital role to play much later in the appearance of Lord Krishna. So at any rate, he finally got his youngest son, Puru? I think Puru took the curse finally. But at any rate, because Yadu would not accept this, Yayati, his father, was very angry, and he cursed Yayati that he and his descendants could not take the throne, could not become kings. And of course, I'm not exactly sure what happened. In some way, Yadu kind of got around this by forming a new dynasty. I think there was an old dynasty, and so he founded the Yadu dynasty, or the Yadavas, come from him. So technically, Ugrasena is part of that Yadu dynasty. So while Krishna is saying, well, I'm not qualified because of this curse, no Yadu prince can become the king, actually Ugrasena was also part of the Yadu dynasty. But it's explained here because Krishna commanded him, of course, it was perfectly all right. Krishna can do what he wants, and he wanted to install Ugrasena, who was a just and rightful king, to be on the throne. So anyway, Krishna sort of took care of business there. He didn't want that position himself. He set up Vasudeva to be like his minister and advisor. And so everything was rightfully restored within the kingdom. So Krishna took care of that business, and then he also made sure that he took care of his relationships. Of course, at the end of the last chapter, when Krishna has just performed all these incredible Herculean tasks and has killed Kamsa, his parents, Devaki and Vasudeva, understood this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So they sort of stood before him, and they didn't know what to do. It says they were paralyzed because knowing he was God, but they didn't want to embrace him as their natural maternal and paternal instincts would be. But at the same time, they didn't want to bow down before him because that would have been improper because he was their son. So they stood there with their hands folded, a little bit not quite sure what to do. Krishna, out of his great kindness, saw their perplexity and sort of their anxiety, and he again covered them with yoga maya so that their vatsalya rasa could predominate. And again, they saw Krishna as their long-lost child, their wonderful son, Krishna. And so they embraced Krishna, and we see this wonderful scene, this wonderful situation, as they're reunited After so many years of separation and all of the pain and tribulation that Vasudeva and Devaki went through, now Krishna has relieved all of that and he has come back to them as their son. And of course, for the rest of Krishna's duration, in this particular appearance on the planet, they will be the ones who will have most of the relationship and the connection with him, because he doesn't go back to Vrindavan. So in other words, all of their paternal and maternal desires are fulfilled by him. So we're seeing these very deep, loving sentiments of the Vatsala Rasa, and they're very, very sweet and very wonderful. And we see this throughout, particularly the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, in Krishna's relationships with his devotees in Vrindavan. Now we've moved into the Mathura Leela, and then, of course, later Krishna will be going to Dwarka. But we see that this one theme is there throughout, that Krishna has these wonderful, loving relationships with his devotees. And they're very, very deep, they're very wonderful, they're very transcendental, and they have great variety. Of course, Krishna has relationships in so many different ways. This is only one of the five principal rasas, the Vatsalya Rasa, which he has and he shows with his parents. So this is really one of the bases of Krishna consciousness, of understanding what is Krishna consciousness, understanding bhakti yoga. Is a lot of it is about understanding the science of rasa, as Prabhupada would say, understanding relationships and how we also have this eternal relationship with Krishna. Now, of course, when many people read these pastimes, they might assume that, you know, Krishna is acting like a human being, and therefore God can't really do this because God must be doing something else. This is what human beings do, and we're simply projecting, this upon God. This is the concept of anthropomorphism, or technically anthropopathism. In other words, that we see our qualities as human beings, and we project those on, well, God must be like us. Actually, it's the other way around. You know, God is eternal, God is the original, God is the prototype of all relationships, and our existence, even our forms, our bodies, our relationships, everything that we do somewhat resembles the forms, relationships, and activities of God. So that is the reality. The reality is that God has a spiritual form, but that spiritual form is quite different than any material form, because it does not have the downsides, it doesn't have the disqualifications or the problems of material bodies. Bhagavad Gita 4:6, Krishna says, Ajopi san apiyatma bhutanam ishvaropi san prakritim svadishtaya sambhavam yatma mayaya. Although I am unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all living entities, I still appear in every millennium in my own transcendental form. So Krishna confirms that this form that he exhibits when he comes to the material world to enact these pastimes is completely spiritual, it is completely transcendental, and it is his original form. His transcendental body never deteriorates, it is unborn. So we can understand that same spiritual form that Krishna exhibited in Vrindavan and Mathura and Dwarka is that same original spiritual form that is there in Goloka Vrindavan. So Krishna's relationships with his devotees are the basis of all relationships. To understand our relationships in this material world, we have to first understand Krishna's relationships. Sometimes it's said that the material world is a perverted reflection of the spiritual world. So everything is there, everything is contained within the spiritual world. Everything is contained within Krishna. There's nothing that is outside of him. So anything that we see in this material world must be there in the absolute, must be there in the supreme. But it's there in its pure form, not in its imperfect form. In the material world, relationships are imperfect. They always have some fault. There's always some flaw. Where in the spiritual world, those relationships are there in perfection and pure and purity. There's a nice explanation of this that Srila Prabhupada gives in the Adi Lila 156. In that purport, Srila Prabhupada says, one should understand through the transparent medium of the spiritual master that the Supreme Lord exists everywhere in his transcendental spiritual nature. and that the living entity's relationships with the Lord are directly and indirectly existing everywhere, even in this material world. In the spiritual world, there are five kinds of relationships with the Supreme Lord: Santa, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. The perverted reflections of these rasas are found in the material world. Land, home, furniture, and other inert material objects are related in Santa, or the neutral and silent sense, whereas servants work in the Dasya relationship. The reciprocation between friends is called Sakya, and the affection of a parent for a child is known as Vatsalya, and the affairs of conjugal love constitute Madhurya. These five relationships in the material world are distorted reflections of the original pure sentiments, which should be understood and perfected in relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. In the material world, the perverted rasas bring frustration. If these rasas are reestablished with Lord Krishna, the result is eternal blissful life. So a nice description by Srila Prabhupada of how we can understand these relationships, we can understand these rasas a little bit, because the reflection of them is also found in the material world. So whatever we see here is that reflection, although, as Prabhupada is saying, in the material world, those relationships often bring about frustration, where in the spiritual world, they bring about eternal happiness. So as devotees, we want to develop relationships. We want to develop spiritual relationships. And we want to spiritualize all those relationships that we're in. Of course, the perfection of relationship is in the spiritual world, in Goloka. And we also see, as Krishna exhibits, in his earthly pastimes. So his pastimes and relationships demonstrate perfect relationships. They're more or less the prototype. This is the perfection. If you want to know what real love between mother and child is, then look at Devaki and Krishna, or Yashoda and Krishna. If you want to look at the highest type of friendship, look at Krishna and the cowherd boys, like that. So we have this established as the perfection of these relationships. Where in the material world, those same relationships exist, as Prabhupada says, but they're all flawed in some respect. You know, we look for happiness in those relationships, but there's always some disappointment. There's always something that's not quite perfect. Of course, Prabhupada said once that the closest to a spiritual relationship that we'll find in the material world is the relationship between the mother and child. This is our closest understanding of spiritual relationship. Why? Because it's the most selfless. And we see that. I mean, a mother will do anything for the child. It's very, very selfless. The mother gets very little in return. Fathers do, of course. But the parent gets very little in return in many ways. Of course, it's very gratifying in many ways. There's relationship and affection. That's there. But it's very, very selfless. You know, there's not a lot that you get out of, you know, being a parent, particularly, except for the satisfaction of the service itself. And that's very much like spiritual life. The satisfaction is in the service itself and the relationship, not that one gains something material from it. So our primary purpose in this material world, of course, is to get out of our material conceptions of life, to understand that we're not the body, the mind, the intelligence, and to reestablish our spiritual life. And reestablishing our spiritual life means reestablishing our loving relationship with God, with Krishna. So that's our primary focus. Our primary purpose is to develop within ourselves that loving relationship with Krishna. But at the same time, we know that Krishna is never alone. It's not that there's, you know, when I go back to the spiritual world, if I go back to the spiritual world, that there'll be Krishna and me and nobody else. You know, I just, somehow it's like, no. Krishna is always with his countless devotees and having relationships with many millions and billions and trillions and uncounted numbers of people, of devotees, of jivas who are in the spiritual world. And because Krishna is unlimitedly powerful, he has the ability to simultaneously have relationships with every single living entity. And that's something that's just totally astounding to us. We can't even imagine, you know, that one living entity could have unlimited relationships with unlimited numbers of other living entities. But this is the nature of Krishna. This is Krishna, by definition. This is who Krishna is, what he is able to do. Because we are all part and parcels of Krishna, we are all expanded marginal energy jivas from Krishna, you know, then we are always in connected with Krishna, and Krishna knows our heart, and Krishna has this eternal relationship with every one of us. So all of the living entities are dear to Krishna. And as the devotee advances in Krishna consciousness, we understand that every living entity is part and parcel of Krishna. Every living entity has an eternal relationship with Krishna, and therefore they're dear to Krishna. So naturally, all of those living entities, and particularly those devotees of Krishna, are also dear to us. And we should have loving relationships with those devotees. And not only is it something that we should do just because we know other parts of Krishna, so I guess I have to get along with them, but rather it's a very positive thing. We know that the process of sadhu sangha is one of the essential angas of bhakti. One of the five most important elements of devotional service is sadhu sangha. Associating with the saintly personalities, the sadhus, the devotees, the bhaktas. So that association with other devotees is very, very essential to our spiritual life. It helps us to grow, it helps us to advance, it helps us to remember Krishna. Why do we want to associate with devotees? Because they are worshiping Krishna, they are serving Krishna, and we see other devotees, we are reminded of Krishna. We are reminded of devotional service. They remind us, we remind them, and we perform service together, and therefore increasing devotional service. So those relationships are very important. And even while we're in the material world, we should try to cultivate and develop those spiritual relationships. Just as there's affection within a family, it's natural. One has affection towards one's children. Children have affection towards the parents, the brothers, the sisters. Because it's part of the same family, there's naturally affection. So when we see that Krishna is the father of all living entities, then naturally there's that same sense of family affection that we have for all of Krishna's devotees. In that relationship, in that association with Krishna's families of devotees, there's actually a spiritual safety. There's a sense of, you know, these are relationships that we know are going to help us in Krishna consciousness. They don't distract us. They're not going to take us away. They're not going to continue our attachment to the material world. By taking shelter of devotees is really none different than taking shelter of Krishna, because it helps us to advance in Krishna consciousness. It helps us to remember Krishna. And so that association is very, very important, and we should always stay in association of devotees. I may have mentioned this before, but when I was in Mayapur last February, there was a number of seminars, and Niranjana Swami was giving the seminar. I don't remember the topic of what it was, but one thing he mentioned I thought was very, very, very interesting. He was quoting from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and I forget the source, which book it was, but Bhaktivinoda Thakur actually discussed this idea that many times in our life, ordinary life, we have to associate with non-devotees. You know, in our work or whatever it may be, it's a natural thing. The devotee is going to have to be with non-devotees. And Bhaktivinoda said, it's not a problem if we don't repose our affection there. In other words, we can associate with non-devotees, but we don't give our heart. It's not where we form our deep relationships. It's not our source of comfort. It's not our source not of enjoyment exactly, but our source of satisfaction and everything that we get out of relationships. In other words, reserve that for devotees. In other words, give your heart to devotees, give your affection, give your relationships, give your all of that to the family of devotees. Then one is safe. Even if one needs to associate because of circumstances with non-devotees, which many of us need to, it's just sort of a natural part of material life. But you know, but save one's heart in that way, one's affection, and develop and cultivate these relationships with devotees. This is, of course, one of the qualities of the Majjhimadikari, the middle level devotee that Srila Prabhupada said we should aspire to. We should first try to become Majjhim devotees, not to try to jump to becoming Uttama Adhikari, one who sees everything in relationship with Krishna, sees every living entity as part and parcel of Krishna, and of course that's the goal, and we should develop a mentality. But the Majjhima Adhikari position is where we first stop. And in the Majjhima Adhikari position, the relationships are with devotees. And one wants to associate, appreciate, and serve devotees. You know, avoid those who are demoniac, preach to those or help those who are innocent, those who are not devotees, you know, offer our kindness, offer our compassion coming through our spiritual master to them, and develop this association in different levels with different devotees. So, of course, a pure devotee sees everything in relation with Krishna. The Uttama Adhikari doesn't necessarily make distinction. But even the Uttama Adhikari, it's described, descends to the Majjhima Adhikari position to be able to preach within the material world. Because otherwise, how could one make distinction? In other words, if one has seen everything is perfect, everything is in relation with Krishna, everyone is part and parcel of Krishna, they all have eternal relationship, then what's the purpose of preaching? In a sense, one has to also simultaneously have this vision that there are distinctions. There are those who have not yet realized the relationship with Krishna. They are devotees, but they don't know that they're devotees, or they haven't, at least on the conscious level, they haven't accepted that relationship. So we want to help to remind them of the relationship with Krishna, help them to connect again with devotional service. And of course, that mission of the devotee is fairly obvious. We understand the mission that Srila Prabhupada had, the mission that Srila Prabhupada gave to us, you know, to help the non-devotees understand their relationship with Krishna through preaching, distributing books, distributing prasadam, having people come to the temples to see the deities, and of course, especially in this age of Kali, through the chanting of the holy name, who somehow or another began the process of chanting Hare Krishna. And that process of chanting Hare Krishna will help one to establish the relationship with God, because Krishna and his name are non-different. So in this way, we can relate perfectly to everyone. So of course, in the beginning stage of devotional service, in the sadhana stage, you know, our practice is not at the perfect level. And we are trying to advance in Krishna consciousness by developing the consciousness of a pure devotee. Although we are not yet pure, we try to act in such a way that we become purified. And so all of our practices of sadhana may not be perfect, but it's on the path towards perfection. In the same way, our relationships may still be flawed, and we still may have so many different attractions, but at least we try to situate ourselves rightly in such a way that we can make advancement in those relationships. So in the beginning, all of our activities are not necessarily completely in alignment with Krishna. So we still may be in that process of mixed devotional service, karma mishra bhakta, where we still have material desires while we execute the process of Krishna consciousness, which is all right, as long as we are performing devotional service under the order of the spiritual master, then we know that it's just simply a question of time that separates us from pure devotional service. In other words, the path is there, we're on the path, it's just going to take some time to go down that path to become purified. So we try to more and more align ourselves with Krishna and Krishna's service in everything we do. I was thinking, I think this was a brief time in history, about when I was in junior high or something. You know, they had what they called new math. This was 50 years ago, so I don't know how new it is or was, you know, 50, more than 50. You know, anyway, and one of the things they started teaching was set theory, you know, and so I remember that they were teaching some of these Venn diagrams. You know, your name's heard? Okay, you're familiar with this. So basically, you know, you have sets and you have these diagrams, and how much do they intersect? Are they contained? Is one contained within the other and all of that? I'm not quite sure what the practical application of it is, but I thought of one in this example. So it's kind of like, you know, you try to use everything Krishna consciousness. So something I remember back in eighth grade, I'll see if I can somehow make some use of it. So if we have two sets here, we have these two circles. One is all of our devotional activities, and one is all of our material activities, or everything that we have to do in the material world in relationship with the material body. Okay, so we've got these two different sets of activities. You know, and sometimes they seem very close and sometimes they seem a little bit separate, right? So for a non-devotee, those two circles are pretty much totally separate. There's very little overlap. There's just really material life. Or perhaps if someone is a little bit pious or a little bit religious, they go to church on Sunday or something. There's a little bit of God here, so there's a little tiny bit of intersection between their material and spiritual life. Now, for a beginning devotee, of course, the circles begin to intersect. There's still some separation, but there's more and more spiritual life starts to come into the material life. In fact, this is the way that Srila Prabhupada preached to us and how we preach to people in the beginning. We say, don't give up anything, don't change your life, just add Krishna consciousness, right? And it works. It's not like it's a ruse or something. It actually works. As we add Krishna consciousness into our life, that becomes more and more part of all of our activities. And because it actually gives more pleasure, because it gives, you know, such spiritual satisfaction, it starts to replace the material activities. And those material activities, you know, become lessened. There's less attraction to them, less attachment, but there's still some. And so as we become more and more advanced, there's more and more overlap of those two circles, where more and more of our activity becomes purely Krishna conscious, and the material activities are a little bit more on the peripheral, a little bit more on the side. And of course, when one reaches the stage of pure devotional service for the Uttam Adhikari, the two circles overlap completely. There's no difference. There's no real difference in material and spiritual life. All those, even the so-called material activities, are completely spiritualized. I mean, Srila Prabhupada had a material body when he was here on this planet, and he had to take care of a material body. But everything he did was completely Krishna conscious. Krishna was there within everything, within every thought, within every activity. And even the maintaining of the material body was simply because the body is a vehicle to serve Krishna. So that's the mood of the pure devotee. There's no distinction between the material and the spiritual. So as devotees, our goal is to increase that overlap. Less and less material, more and more spiritual. So, you know, we don't need to beat ourselves up and be completely guilty that we're not completely there, that we still have some material attachment, some material activity. That's going to be there because of our many, many lifetimes in this material world, in material bodies. So we still have a great amount of attachment to these material bodies, but it's lessening. It's becoming lessened. And every day that we perform devotional service, every mantra, every time we chant Hare Krishna, we're increasing that spiritual consciousness and decreasing the material hold, the material and the material attachment. So we try to see that all of our duties, whether it's in family life, whether it's our work, whatever it is, that these are not separate from Krishna and separate from Krishna consciousness. Devotees sometimes struggle quite a bit with, I have so many material activities to perform. I have all of these duties. I barely have time for Krishna consciousness. So what we need to do is not to say, all right, how can I get rid of or dump all of those, material duties or obligations and just do spiritual activities? That's not right either. That's not what Krishna told Arjuna. That was Arjuna's proposition, right? Okay, this is all troublesome. This is going nowhere. It's family entanglement. It's just, there's no good that's going to come out of this. Let me just become renounced and just, take purely to spiritual life. Krishna said, no. He said, you're talking like a fool. He called him a fool for proposing this. He said, your duty is a kshatriya. And your duty to serve me is to perform your duty, to perform your work for me, upon my order, for my satisfaction. When Krishna finally, when the veil of illusion was lifted, and Arjuna becomes supposedly enlightened, re-enlightened, it's clear to him. It's clear to him that his position, his duty, is simply do everything he does, but do it for Krishna. Do it under Krishna's order. So that's our position. We simply need to, whatever our obligations are, whatever our duties are, whatever our relationships are in this material world, we do them for Krishna. And gradually, as I said, more and more we see how those can become Krishna conscious, how those activities can all become spiritualized. And this is also true in all of our relationships. Sometimes relationships devotees may find to be one of the more difficult aspects in the process of surrender, in the process of spiritual advancement, because we find ourselves in relationships that by their very nature have very strong attachment involved in them, right? I mean, often people's relationships with others is, you know, maybe the strongest attachments that they have in this material world. So that is why we have to particularly work on our relationships and see how our relationships become spiritualized, how they also become avenues for Krishna consciousness, how they become, you know, not, just saw this saying that I kind of liked. It was talking about, you know, if there's a stone in your path, it can, you know, a rock in your path, you can see it as a stepping stone, or you can see it, you know, as an obstacle. As you can see, you know, it's either an obstacle in your path or it becomes a stepping stone. In other words, it's kind of like in Krishna consciousness, you know, we can take everything as an opportunity to serve Krishna, or as a difficulty, as a problem, as an obstacle for Krishna consciousness. And there are obstacles. There are obstacles in our path of Krishna consciousness. But those obstacles are also opportunities. They're opportunities for us to understand, how can I serve Krishna better? How can I surrender to Krishna? Maybe what I have to learn at this moment is simply that I have to surrender. I have to depend upon Krishna, even though there is this trouble or this obstacle or this difficulty. You know, and sometimes that requires that we simply have to pray and surrender and chant and try to understand how we can best serve Krishna in the circumstance that I've been put in. And so in our relationships, we need to see how Krishna can become the center, how they can become Krishnaized, how they can become spiritualized, and how they can lead to advancement in Krishna consciousness. You know, I don't want to embarrass you, but we have a wonderful example here of Hanuman Prabhu brought his whole family here to Srimad Bhagavatam class. Wonderful example of how to take that relationship in the family and make it Krishna conscious as a way for everyone to advance. And that's the role and that's the duty of the parent, you know, to help the child to become Krishna conscious, you know, and then that's the perfection of family life. That's the perfection of parenthood. And there's no loss, there's no problem, there's no difficulty if we're performing those duties to advance in Krishna consciousness. Okay. Of course, and then we have the perfect examples here in Krishna's relationships and his loving treatment and relationship with his parents, Devaki and Vasudeva. Okay, so I'll stop at that point. Are there any questions or comments? Mm-hmm. Yes, Janmasthami Prabhu. Well, by the way, welcome to Alachua. Good to see you. Hey, Krishna.
Prabhu, this, it may seem like a little bit of a hair splitting, topic that I'm bringing up, but it seems to me that if someone is practicing Uttama Bhakti, and he's practicing pure devotional service, then that would make him a pure devotee. You know, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that come from the acharyas that's the case.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, you know, there's an equation between the platform of Uttama Bhakti, and that only that is a pure devotee. But, like for instance, in the 11th canto, 20th chapter, verses 27 and 28, this describes the beginning of the practice of pure devotional service, and there's a particular mood that even if one is still contaminated by his previous sinful activities and still has some material desires, there's still a facility to practice pure devotional service. And there's a wonderful quote that Gopi Prandhan uses in the purport to these two verses that describes the mood, you know, of someone, kind of the attitude that one has to take on in order to actually isolate himself from these material desires and practice pure devotional service. If you don't mind, I can just read it. It's really powerful.
Well, can you summarize it just for
it kind of like says it very concisely. It's about a 1 minute read.
Okay.
It would take longer for me to try and paraphrase
okay.
it than it would to read. I mean, like Prabhupada says in the preface to Nectar of Instruction, that advancement in Krishna consciousness is based upon the attitude of the follower. So this is the attitude mm-hmm. that one can imbibe and actually begin the process of pure devotional service. Here's the commentary. And Gopi Parantan just includes it as kind of a long quote. By my previous shameful life, my heart is polluted with many illusory attachments. Personally, I have no power to stop them. Only Lord Krishna within my heart can remove such inauspicious contamination. But whether the Lord removes such attachments, immediately, or lets me go on being afflicted by them, I will never give up my devotional service to Him. Even if the Lord places millions of obstacles in my path, and even if because of my offenses I go to hell, I will never for a moment stop serving Lord Krishna. I'm not interested in mental speculation and fruitive activities, even if Lord Brahma personally comes before me offering such engagements. I will not be even slightly interested. Although I'm attached to material things, I can see very clearly that they lead to no good because they simply give me trouble and disturb my devotional service to the Lord. Therefore, I sincerely repent my foolish attachments to so many material things, and I am patiently awaiting Lord Krishna's mercy.
It's a wonderful verse, and one of my favorites too.
Yeah,
the in the verse itself isn't the word that it's a mood of regret or repentance.
That's it's a repentant that, mood.
Yeah, but it's a very hopeful verse.
Yeah,
because Krishna is assuring the devotee that even if he has material attachment, you know, that there's great hope. You know, that one will advance if one is in that right mood, in that proper mood, not an arrogant mood, but a mood of, you know, my dear Lord Krishna, I'm so sorry. I repent that I have these material attachments. But one simply continues happily in devotion, continues joyfully or happily in devotional service, and one will continue. A wonderful verse. Thank you for sharing that.
There's also a very interesting reference from Jivadharma, where Bhaktivinoda Thakur parallels or actually equates the initiation of the practice of Uttama Bhakti, which is described here. You know, really trying to work within the parameters of the definition of Uttama Bhakti, and also, you know, coming to the Madhyama Vaishnava platform. So, in other words, that the Madhyama Vaishnava platform would involve not having mixed devotion. That's really kind of the turning point. I can actually send it to you. It's a really convincing, you know, discussion that he has in there on this.
Okay, let's take a couple of Mataji, a couple here. Go ahead. Sukhita.
Now, I understand theoretically that Uttama Adhikara is the highest platform. You're seeing everything that's going on. Krishna's, you know, in control. But it almost seems a bit impersonal in comparison. Like, you know, we hear that Srila Prabhupada came down to the Madhyama Adhikara platform, you know, just a bit, it seems more advanced because it seems more personal, like you're recognizing the suffering that Livananis are going through and you're willing to get involved and help. So I guess...
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Coming down or descending almost doesn't seem like the appropriate phrase for that. I mean,
right.
I mean, I think Prabhupada does use that phrase, that one descends or takes on the Madhyama. Because actually, obviously we see the sentiment of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you know, in some ways you could say was that very sentiment to understand the suffering of the conditioned souls and to bring them to Krishna consciousness. Yeah, I don't think we need to consider that a lower platform or anything. You know, but it does require the consciousness of understanding the suffering of a living entity in the material world. You know, that's accurate. Kelsey?
Thank you very much, Tamaharpu. You spoke about how we're not supposed to take the association of of non-devotees, and that we should, you know, relish our family here under the shelter of Prabhupada. But I'm thinking, I'll just give you the context of my questions. I'm about to, after being spoiled by such wonderful association, I'm about to go back to school and take the association of so many non-devotees. And so the majority of the people that I'm around are going to be non-devotees. And I've been told, you know, like, it's really important. I feel like, in one sense, it's an amazing opportunity to try to give them some association.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I'm, like, nervous because I, like, how do you give them association when you're not so strong, maybe? And how do you protect yourself? I feel like we see, like, the best preaching is when people see that you actually care about them, mm-hmm. and when you really open your hearts to them. So how do you simultaneously open your heart to non-devotees while protecting yourself from the negative aspects of their association?
That's a very good question. It's easy to say that we give them our association, or that our relationship should be one of, you know, with one of preaching or trying to help them or somehow give them Krishna consciousness. In reality, we know that when there's a lot of association there, it's very difficult to just remain on that platform with other living entities. You know, there's naturally going to be some exchange. There's other types of relationships, you know, just in the natural course of things, particularly other people you're going to course classes with, things like that. Might be people we work with. I think that it's kind of still going back to what Bhaktivinoda Thakur said about not really giving our heart, not reposing our affection. And there is a way of doing that. You can be cordial. You can be friendly with people. You can be caring for people, because it really does care about other living entities. It's not that we don't. It's not that we're, you know, harsh, that we're heartless, that, you know, well, we don't care about them, they're just karmis or whatever. Like, no. They are living entities who are suffering. But somehow or another, Krishna has given me the opportunity to associate with these people. Therefore, you do have some opportunity through that relationship. And we know that people do respond to relationships. So, in a sense, if you are giving of yourself in terms of your spirituality, of your Krishna consciousness, of who you are as a devotee, then that is only going to benefit them. You know, but I think we need to be a little careful about, I guess it's all the aspects of life that we tend to, you know, that we share easily with friends and family, particularly if they're devotees, that we need to be a little careful about. I mean, I worked about a good 15 years out in the material world, you know, while I was a devotee, so I'm very familiar with this. And, you know, and you do have to maintain a certain level of relationships. And what I found is I really just try to minimize them. You know, I declined a lot of social invitations, things like that, you know. And in other words, I was just very careful about that relationship and about those associations. You know, and sometimes, and of course, when you have those opportunities, if somebody, because there is a little bit of relationship, and you have an opportunity to give Krishna consciousness, obviously you do it, or you distribute prasadam or whatever you can do. You take those opportunities. And I think it's a little bit of a juggle. It's a little tricky, but, you know, you're an intelligent devotee, and I think you'll figure it out, and Krishna will help you. you'll know what to do and what not to do. I think you'll be fine. Okay. Prabhu.
I had a question, but before the question, I guess maybe a response also to her, if, with your permission.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can I also respond to her question?
Oh,
with,
sure.
With your permission?
Yes, please.
So the verse for the Madhyama Adhikari is that Dvishatsu Upeksha, those who are envious, you ignore. And Balisheshu Kripa, those are innocent, you give mercy. So, you know, the Madhyam Adhikari has to have the smarts, I guess, to figure out who is innocent and who is
discrimination.
The discrimination. Yeah. So if you can figure out who is innocent, mm-hmm. then there's no problem sharing Krishna consciousness with them and your heart and preaching. But if they're envious, which you can tell based on a few conversations, then upeksha means just neglect completely. You don't want to do anything with them because for the madhyama adhikari, that's dangerous. The question I had for your first part of the class, Vasudev and Devaki, the veil of illusion has lifted and now they're paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
How can, you know, this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and he can't be our son, he's the God. But then it got me thinking, in their previous lives, like Sutapa and Prishni, they perform severe austerities to get God as their son. So it seems almost like a contradiction. Without the veil of yoga maya, it's difficult for them to conceive of God as their son, but at the same time the desire to have God as their son.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Devaki and Vasudeva have a little bit different relationship than Yashoda and Nanda. Yashoda and Nanda were almost always under yoga maya, right? They were, you know, pretty much thinking, this is my son, although they would get these glimpses. Is Krishna something very special? He seems very powerful. Maybe he's Narayan, you know. But generally, they were always in that mood where it seems that Devaki and Vasudeva, that mood would, you know, change. Because when he was first born, he appeared as Narayan, right? Four-handed form, the whole thing. So they knew, in other words, both things were there. They were satisfied and they were gratified that, you know, that Krishna had become their son. So they have that knowledge. Yes, he has appeared. He fulfilled it. He his third birth. So they understood that he completely fulfilled their desire that God would be their son. At the same time, then he would cover them with yoga maya so they could enjoy that vatsalya rasa, that relationship as parents. And so it seems with them there's a little more lifting and covering, you know, goes on. You know, it's a slightly different mood. You know, it's very interesting, actually, the way that sometimes, oh my gosh, this is Krishna, and then, oh, it's just my little son, Krishna and Balaram. One more?
Yeah.
We're almost out of time here. Yeah. Was there anything? Oh, I'm sorry. Magunda.
Yeah, the last analogy was very good, actually. That was perfect. The discussion about Srila Prabhupada and Uttamadhikari. So Rupa Goswami described that Uttamadhikars of three types. One is called Bhagavad Parasa Deha Prapt. That means, like example of Vamsi Das Babaji, when he was in this world, sometimes he used to go out begging, and the little kids would throw stones at him. And then he would come back to his deity and tell him, today I could collect nothing, because you, Krishna, and all of your friends harassed me so much, I was unable to collect, so today we're all fasting. So this example of Bhagavad Parasa Deha Prapt. Someone who is called Nirdut Kushai means he's also Uttamadhikari like that, but he comes down to the level to make distinction who needs help, who doesn't need help, etc. He's not a lower level, he just comes to a level of perception to see who needs help. So in Upadeshamrita, also Nectar of Instruction, in the eighth or ninth verse, I can't remember, but it says, Sushushaya Bhajan Vijnanam Ananyam Anya Ninda Adi Sunya Ridoya Ipsita Sangalabhya. Two kinds of Mahabhagavata association is very favorable. So one is who's bhajan vigyan. He realized his bhajan and he's exclusively engaged in serving Krishna. The other person is Ninda Adi Sunya Ridoya. In his heart, he has, Ninda means more than just blasphemy, it also means to critique. Like when we do it to ghosts, he say, we should do this, we shouldn't do that. There's also a Ninda. So it says, Ninda Adi Sunya Ridoya. In that person's heart, he has no capacity to critique. He's also a pure devotee, but like Vamsi Das Babaji, it would not be very helpful for us because if we go there, he's not going to be able to see, you need help, you need to do this, you need to do that. The other person is also Bhajan Vigyan. He's also a self-realized soul, but he's on the platform to help you and see, this is it. So he's not lower.
I think that was very helpful, and it's the descending or coming to a lower isn't really the right concept, and that's a nice explanation, and we can find that in what, eighth or ninth verse of Nectar Instruction, see?
Yeah,
somewhere there.
Okay,
that's very good. Thank you. We should end at this point. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.